Good evening, Mud Babies, Pod People, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. I'm out on the road. I'm in Oklahoma City right now. I've been working with Dwight York, another comic, for a couple weeks now, and I'm going to get him to sit down here in a second and chat with me in the comics condo. We're going to do this on one microphone, so it may sound a little weird, but I hope you like it. So hold on. I'll be right back with Dwight. Now, Dwight is a one-liner comic, and so I'm going to try to get him to do a few of those for you, and I know you're going to love it. Here you go. It's Remasculate from the Loony Bin in Oklahoma City.
Old guy.
The what?
The bitter, weird old guy.
The guy that frightens you? You scare me!
I mean, from the comics perspective. Oh. Like,
dad. They do the whole what?
My dad would like your act.
That's what they tell you? My dad would like...
I get a sense that some of them, you know... I don't know. No one's ever said anything to me. You know, I don't know. I do get a lot of love and respect from a lot of comics around the country.
That's good. I'm sitting here in Oklahoma City. It's the condo at Loony Bin. We're at Loony Bin's Comedy Club. With Dwight York. You may have seen him on...
You know, I've been doing comedy for 24 years, been on countless TV shows. That's right, zero.
You can't count them. Is that what you're saying?
That's open with a joke. I did that joke once before, and actually I've only been on national TV once, and that was on the WGN, the Bob and Tom TV show, which really isn't a TV show. They had cameras in the studio.
I remember that.
They had it down for an hour, and it was like... It was like a worse version of Howard Stern.
Yeah. But they didn't really move around a lot. I remember it was like cameras pointed right there at the studio.
And there was no chicks with taking their tops off. So
yeah. Nothing to really keep the visual thing alive. Is that what you're saying?
So what's the point?
Yeah. So Dwight, where are you from and where did you start comedy?
I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin and about an hour from the Twin Cities. So I was a Minneapolis comic. And I still call that home. My home club now would be the Joke Joint, but I cut my teeth on clubs like the Comedy Gallery was the big chain at the time, and the Acme.
Hanson
was big in the day.
Yeah, so I know all those the guys because I was hanging with Jeff Cesario and Louis Anderson and a lot of those guys.
I missed that first initial comedy boom, but it was Minneapolis was one of the hot cities.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott Hansen, Louis Anderson, Cesario, Joel Madison, Sid Youngers, there was a bunch of guys that came
out. Yeah, Sid and Joel, they went on to be producers in TV, right?
There's still some heavy Minneapolis, footprint, thumbprint, something out in L.A. There's a lot of guys.
Footprint, thumbprint.
There's some Minneapolis comics that made it, left.
And then there's others that have been fingerprinted and sent to jail.
Yeah, then there's that other bunch of comics that came back to Minneapolis that never made it out in L.A. and were just bitter.
That's not you, though.
I'm bitter for different reasons.
What would be the reasons for you?
You know...
And I don't really think you're bitter. We've been working for 2 weeks together now. You're not really bitter. You're just a hard-working, I don't know why I haven't gotten my break yet.
You know, and and some of it is just, you know, my dour attitude off stage where some people can think I'm bitter, and I'm quick to make a self-deprecating joke, which some people like, oh, you're sharing too much. I'm just trying to be funny. If you can't make fun of yourself, personally, that's one of my big deals. But, you know, it is tough to make a living in this business as a comic in the first place, but you know what? My act is different.
You're a one-line liner act, and very funny one-liners. I mean, throw out one or two of what you... I hate to put you on the spot because I know how this is, but throw out one or two of your best, what you consider your best one-liner jokes.
Tom Griswold liked this one a lot from the Bob and Tom show. It's a little bit dated now, but I was homeless for a while. Didn't want people to know, so I slept in front of a Ticketmaster. And one of my old school classic kind of jokes, I had a job once selling security alarms door to door. I was really good at it. There was no one home. I'd leave a brochure in the kitchen table.
Aye! See, very good joke. Bum, bum, bum.
And you know, and but I also, besides doing non sequitur one liner jokes, they're rapid fire, more in the. But I also do kind of a character act, and you know, I got kind of a weird, wacky look, and I'm not selling personality. So I mean, I'm selling my jokes, and I suppose I have a way of delivering it that's funny. Some people say my look helps, you know, helps the joke. But let's face it, the crowd is not like, oh, we like this guy. We want him to succeed. They're in the back of their chairs going, what the fuck?
I know.
Well, I can swear?
You do have, oh, yeah. You do have a little bit of a Raising Arizona, I just got released from prison, hope you like my jokes because I don't want to go back look about you.
Raising Arizona. I love it.
Wasn't that a great movie?
Yeah, I got to see it again. And in the audience, and part of the reason when my act does work is people are a little, there's a nervous tension because this guy's fucked. There's something wrong with this guy. What's wrong with this guy? They don't know what to expect. So there's that nervousness in the show. But, you know, sometimes I go out on stage, though, and the audience decides they like me from the moment I come out. I'm a long-haired, hippie-looking guy. I look like I may be stuck in the 70s or something. Maybe that drifter. The local newspaper described my character as a two-bitted, dimwit weasel still wearing the vapors of last night's high.
What?
And I think they meant that as a compliment. So anyway, so when I walk on stage, but some people think that's just great because they don't want to hear the comic that's wearing the tie or the cool shirt and tennis shoes that's all hip. You know, they want to hear the drug drinking and dick jokes. And when I walk on stage, my people immediately, yeah, we're gonna like this guy, which is why I do shows like the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally.
Right, right. You work at the Buffalo Chip there, the big Buffalo.
The big concert venue at the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. It'll be my fifth year there. And Buffalo Chip, you know, you say the Buffalo Chip campground, like, oh, you do comedy at a campground? Well, unless you've been out there, you don't understand. I mean,
it is not a campground. There's camping there, but it is not a campground.
It is that and more. And
how many thousand?
I don't know. They don't ever give out any attendance data. I asked.
What's your best guess?
I asked the owner. He said somewhere between one and a million and closer to one than a million. That's his standard answer. I don't know. We were guesstimating that for Kid Rock one year that there must have been 40,000. Bob Dylan and Kid Rock were there on the same night.
On the same show or two?
Same show. Bob Dylan, in essence, opened for Kid Rock. And there was a lot of people at the campground. Usually you can ride your motorcycle into the main stage area, except for the big nights.
Yeah.
And that night, they you can't ride your motorcycle because that takes up too much space. And they have a great stage area concert. It's really great for, it's kind of a bowl, and it fits a lot of people. And there it was just wall-to-wall people for, I don't know, like the size of a football field or something.
So as a one-liner comic facing bikers, this is, you're at, was the fear there that, you know, that they're going to like not like my first joke and a beer bottle is going to come flying at your head?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I kind of wanted to do it. It was like, I wasn't doing it because it was easy. I wanted to do it because it was hard. And the reason I went to the Buffalo Chip, by the way, I did a couple of motorcycle rallies, which allayed my fear a little bit. But one night, the first year I was there, here's a story. I had been doing shows all week. Some of them went okay. Some of them didn't. It was hard to find an audience. But I was walking back. I would carry my briefcase with me all the time. I had my product in there. The first year out there, I was doing it because I wanted to sell my book and CD. And I sell a lot of stuff after the show. You would expect that you would get people to buy at the motorcycle rally. I thought it'd be like, you know, minting money out there.
Yeah. No? Because they're out there to vacation and spend money and souvenirs of the trip and...
They are, and a lot of souvenirs are sold, but a lot of people bring souvenirs out there, and a lot of people go home with the truckload of shit they were hoping to sell. I mean, it wasn't just me that goes out there with big dreams of making money at the motorcycle rally. I mean, there so many people, I guess I make the analogy like the gold rush. When somebody went out to the, the gold rush back in, what is it,
whatever. 49ers.
49, you know. Yeah. Sure, there were some guys that made money, but there's a lot of people that didn't find shit.
Just died on the way and dust and...
So anyway, I'm there all week, and I had some good shows, some ups and downs, a lot of disappointments. And basically, I was dejected. I'm walking back, and there's a storm coming. I know a storm's coming, but it's not raining yet. And all of a sudden, something hits me. in the back. Like, what the hell was that? And another white thing went flipping across the ground. It looked like one of those tops of a champagne bottle, you know? And I thought somebody was whipping shit at me because I sucked. Here, it turns out it was hail, and it was hailing so hard, and the wind was blowing some of the hailstones out in front of the storm. About a minute later, just all hell broke loose from the sky. But
thank God you weren't on stage.
Well,
because it felt like God was.
Yeah.
God's heckling you with hail.
There, you know, in the stages we do, there's usually a roof over your head, but. Yeah, we got rained out once this last year where it started hailing while I was on stage. We had to quit, and the roadies were just going crazy trying to cover up the equipment and shit. And like, I better get out of here because there's electricity here.
Do you, when you do this show there, do you camp on site? Like, do you camp in the show? Do you sleep in a tent, wash up, go on stage?
You know, I hate to admit this because, you know, the big star performers stay in RVs, fancy RVs. There's an RV park behind the main stage, which costs thousands of dollars to stay there each week. I'm camping in a fucking tent. It's in a nice location. It's right by the showers, right off the
edge of the toilets.
Yes. And it is very convenient to where I do my comedy. And, you know, it's near Grand Central Station, part of the Buffalo Chip, but it's the elements. And you know what? I don't mind sleeping in a tent. I don't mind. I've got good camping equipment, but the bitch about sleeping outside in a tent at the Buffalo Chip at Sturgis, South Dakota, summer, is the weather. And you know what? When the sun comes up, there's no shade. It's not like a campground where there's a nice little brook running by and trees overhead.
Trees and shade.
It's the prairie. And when the sun comes up, and so you're constantly trying to figure out, way to shade your tent. But the wind out there, and I'm not talking about storms, it just gets to be a windy day, and it blows everything over, you know. And so you can't really, it's just a mess. And then, you're showering with, you know, big biker guys with big guts who aren't afraid to flaunt their,
please, tell more.
It's, you know, I don't chat generally with anybody in
the shower. Do they like to chat in the shower?
Not so much. And it's funny, you see some of these biker guys that are shy. I think that's the funniest thing. You know, little biker kid in his 20s with his mohawk, putting gel in his hair, you know, bringing his pants into the shower so he doesn't have to, I don't know if he's worried that somebody's going to check his junk out or that it doesn't measure up to mine or what.
But the gay, maybe it's the gay biker bunch. Yeah. Wonder what gang does that fall under? You know, there's all the Hell's Angels and the Sons of Silence and is there a gay biker group?
Let's see, what is it called? Butt Pirates for Beelzebub.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
There's no such band. I mean, gang.
Butt Pirates for Beelzebub.
Somebody came up with that name for a comedy short we were trying to do at one point in time. So
I know there was
that was Greg Fiddler, who writes for The Soup. That was his idea for a gay biker gang.
I know there was the whole joke there, you know, the dykes on bikes. That was the whole. So it's been the lesbian bikers, you know.
You know, and they're probably out at the Buffalo Chip. You don't see that diverse of a group of people. They're kind of similar. They're bikers. But you do see some, I would guess that they're lesbian bikers. You know, you see some couples, you see that occasionally. You don't see many black bikers out there.
You don't?
Occasionally.
Because if you watch Sons of Anarchy, there is a whole black biker gang, you know?
I have not seen any black biker gangs. Of course, in this modern day of, you do see some, girlfriends of bikers that are of African-American descent, but you don't see a whole lot of black bikers. Although, I'll tell you what, the Buffalo Chip, it's not that scary. I mean, there's people out there. I've seen some they're openly gay guys, and they're trying to get a rise out of everybody, which gives them a rise.
Well, where else can you wear chaps?
There was this guy wearing chaps and a tiny thong bikini, and I can't remember what it was. He was dressed obviously very effeminate and was walking around and the chicks were checking him out and people were, I've got him on a video on one of my video daily reports. And, you know, and I don't know why this guy was there, but no one was hurting. No one was bothering him. I saw another guy that, he must be in challenge to get into a, when you get into a gang, you have to do initiation or something. He must have been being initiated or something, but he walked up to the pond where they have a little beach there. They have a rope swing, and he went off the rope swing. He walked out there in a bikini at a motorcycle rally.
Brave, brave man.
So they're accepting folks in that regard.
Yeah. So how long have you been out on the road actually doing comedy now?
I started my first open mic night was 1989. I had a day job. I quit that in 1996. And I lived on the road full-time from 1999 to 2007. Stuff in storage, living in comedy condos, hotel rooms.
Tents. You told me the other night, sometimes you don't even get a hotel. You just, like, drive to a gig, stop, sleep in the car, keep going.
I came to this gig, well, the week last week, we did Tulsa. I came from Las Vegas, and instead of stopping halfway, it was too far to do in one day. So instead of stopping halfway through, I drove until I could not stay awake anymore, pulled into a rest area, slept in my car for a few hours, and then continued on. And I kind of prefer that because when you have to stop, you got to go to the hotel, you spend money. By the time you check into the hotel, you're awake again. Now you're sitting there, oh, I got to go to sleep. And so I don't mind sleeping in my car. And one of the things that I have, one of my, I suppose, talent or I was born with a gift that helps me be a comic and live on the road and fly on airplanes is I can sleep anywhere.
That's just exhaustion.
No, I think it's depression.
You think so? Part I know that you do love to sleep. One of the things I've noticed for the 2 weeks that we've worked together, that's why I finally got you caught in here. Today is you like to go, well, I think I'm going to go nap. Well, I'll see you in a few hours. Well,
I love the nap. Yeah, I probably sleep too much. People make fun of me, but, you know, like, I think as a comic especially, you know, you want to hit that stage feeling like, you know, you're on your way to work. It's your first cup of coffee. You're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Is that the right thing? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. But, you know, I've battled that depression thing my whole life. And, you know, some people, when they have a depression, they can't sleep.
Do you feel like you really do have depression? Or?
Well, there's something wrong with me. And, you know, and hereditarily, whatever. My mom was, she battled depression. She had to retire early from teaching. She was hospitalized 3 times, and twice she had electric shock treatments.
Wow, the electric shock. Do they? When was that? I didn't even know they still...
Well, it was a long time ago. I was born in 1961. I was in first grade, so... Whatever that was. I came home from school one day and, where's mom? She's in the nut house.
They didn't actually say that.
No, but she was in a psychiatric hospital and she was gone for a month. And you know what? I was one of those generation where, you know, you were a tough kid. No, we didn't show emotion or whatever, but it was weird. Yeah, and but anyway,
did your dad cook and take care of that stuff and all?
He tried to. The first day, I remember he was cooking. I don't think he'd ever come from that generation. I was the youngest of 5 boys. He was about 45 at the time, and he could not figure out how to make a frozen pizza. There was smoke rolling out of the oven. He's going, "What's going on here?" And I'm looking in. I'm going, "Dad, you got to remove the cardboard."
Oh no!
First.
He slid the whole thing in there?
He did not know. He took the plastic off.
And that's good. Nothing worse than melted plastic on your pizza.
The poor man, though, I mean, he was obviously, you know, devastated by the fact that he had to make the decision, you know, to lock your mom up. Well, I didn't lock her up, you know, to bring her to the hospital. And I mean, she was, you know, I mean, she didn't know what to do. I'm sure she asked her husband, "What should I do? Should I take the doctor's advice? Should I go into the hospital?" I'm sure that, you know, they had to make a joint decision, and I'm sure that weighed heavily on his, you know, mind his entire life.
Did you see a big change in your mom after the treatment, shock treatment?
You know, I don't know. I mean, she came home. She was obviously done. She did not have that worried, I can't sleep, I can't make a decision look on her face. But it, to me, it was, I thought that she lost a twinkle in her eye. It may be a fanciful remembrance that I have that was never actually there. But I wonder if it didn't change her some. But on the other hand, I mean, she was, when somebody, you know, like people take Prozac or whatever they do now, I mean, she was not just mildly, I need something to help pick me up a little bit. I mean, she was, I couldn't get out of the chair. And if I've heard from family members that her, not her mother, but her grandmother was debilitated for a long time, where she didn't get out of a chair, didn't talk to anybody, do anything. And this would have been back in the, you know, 1900 or something, or 1880s or something like that, where they didn't call it anything.
But right.
Grandma just sat in the rocking chair, or it wasn't be grandma at the time. Mom just sat in the rocking chair all day and just rocked for a couple of years and didn't do anything.
And people just talked to the chair. Grandma? You know what I mean? You've seen those movies. Grandma? She's fine. Yeah. Gonna make a sandwich now, Grandma.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, how much of that story was invented, but I'm sure it goes through the, and you know, I've talked to the doctor, I've tried the different antidepressants over the years, you know, and I try them for a while, and I don't really like them, and sleep seems to work well for me.
It kind of resets you, like hitting the reset button?
It's like a reset, you know, my brain is just like all the worry and angst and anxiety and that empty self-loathing feeling. It's just after a time, you just can't take it anymore, so you go to sleep, and then you have miserable dreams, and you wake up, but, you know, yes.
I'm in a condo! Yeah, but your shows are great. I mean, that's what the, from working the 2 weeks, and we've worked before, your shows are always good, it's always done well, it's always professional, yet you feel like your personal life is the mess?
Well, I don't know about, well,
I don't want to say mess.
I don't know if I want to, you know, that's a whole other topic, personal life, professional life. Is there a difference when you're a comic? I mean, really, you are judging your self-worth and self-esteem, I believe, on how well you do on stage. I mean, how I feel depends, you know, on how well the last show went, you know, which sucks, because if your last show on Saturday night was in the tank and you don't have a show for another week, you're feeling like shit for a week. That's part of it, but it's also the success. You know, you're worried about, you know, I'm driving I just bought a new car, which I'm thrilled to get, a 1995 Toyota Corolla. It's only got 100,000 miles on it.
I like the new addition you added to it since we've been here this week.
I got a little digital clock. It didn't have a clock on the car stereo. It's got a tape deck.
Not only does it have a tape deck, it has that little tape that you put in and then you plug into your CD player.
I plug it into my Droid smartphone, and you know, I was thrilled that they still had that. That's one of the first things when I left my friend's house. I flew to Tennessee where the car was. I gave him the money, and then I drove up to Las Vegas. But when the first thing I did was I stopped at Walmart, and I was wondering if they still made those things. I'm thinking, they probably don't even sell
can't
them
get those cassette adapters anymore.
Right. But they had one, and I was like, sweet, I can listen to my cell phone in my new car.
Yeah, so you just were in Vegas. You went out there to scout. You're thinking about wanting to do a one-man show in Vegas?
You know, it's been a dream of mine, and I think my show would work well out there, yes. And I was kind of thinking, well, you know, you could go see Carrot Top for $80. Couldn't I be the poor white trash man's Carrot Top? You know, he's at the fancy casino. He's got the fancy lights with the
lasers and all the stuff.
Like the rock and roll show. And
yeah.
I could be like the lounge guy downtown. You know, maybe the $10 stays in Vegas, comedy hour. Bring the show I do at the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, drug drinking and dick jokes. And kind of the reason I thought of this is because I knew there was no comedy downtown, so I wanted to check out the downtown.
You mean by downtown, like the Fremont section that down there with the... What's the hotel you're thinking about?
Well, it's called the Fremont Street Experience, mm-hmm. and it really has been revitalized. They're doing pretty well. Like there's at night they have bands and the outdoor stages, and all the casinos down there you can walk from one to the other. So it's kind of like a casino mall. But the one I haven't talked to these. I mean, it's a far-fetched idea. It's a Hail Mary pass. It's a it's buying a lottery ticket. No one's going to give me my own room in Vegas.
Well, you never know.
But there's an El Cortez, which I'm going to try to pitch them my idea. And they're off the Fremont Street Experience. That casino's been there for 70 years. It used to cater to locals and old people. And but you know what? A lot of these casinos, they're not owned by... I thought you'd go out there and maybe drop a package off for an entertainment director, but they don't care about the showrooms. They farm that out to some production company or, you know, and they have these shows like One Man Band who does... who blows fireworks out of his ass and does impressions. I don't know what those guys do. But anyway, there's no stand-up comedy downtown, and I don't think there's any really demand for it.
So you think it'd be good to put in a... the $5, $10 show at the Cortez, but then how do you advertise that?
I don't know that you do, and maybe the El Cortez is not the place, but I do. But that the only reason I thought of that is because that's owned by one person, so there's actually somebody you could actually pitch the idea to. You know, otherwise they're owned by these big corporations.
The MGM Experience and all those, or the Wynn Hotel Group. Or
I think so, and but this is a family-owned place is the only reason. Family owned and they're off the beaten path, but I think there is a definite need for some stand-up comedy downtown. My idea was a little bit different, that, you know, like instead of going to the comedy show that you can see at your hometown, which a lot of the, you know, is it the Laugh Factory or the Improv or whatever? I mean, they're great rooms in Las Vegas out on the Strip, but they're no, those shows aren't any different than you could see at the comedy club at the Mall of America in Minneapolis. My idea was a show that was a little shorter in length so that, you know, you wouldn't have to spend your whole evening watching the show. You'd see some quick drug drinking and dick jokes with that adult comedy theme.
Uh-huh.
You know,
and then you'd go hang out at the bar and get hit on by the same... What was the thing you were telling me that... didn't you have an experience just recently in Vegas where you were like, oh...
There was... I met a woman in Las Vegas who I was like... She was awfully friendly, and I kind of wondered afterwards that... I wonder if she's a hooker, you know? And she probably was. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I bought a couple of drinks, but I was out there partying with people, and it was kind of fun because, you know, when you're out in that atmosphere, people, they're on vacation, and, you know, there was a while where I didn't think I talked to any women, but there's all these, you know, these older ones. That lady was, she was from Las Vegas because she was going out to some, the reason I brought that story up was because, I was like, it was time for me to go home, and she was going to another bar, and I was just amazed at how young people could keep partying like that, because the bars are open 24 hours right. In Las Vegas.
And she wanted you to go to another bar?
I don't think so, no. I don't think she wanted that, no. I think she was happy I bought her a couple of drinks, and that was probably about enough.
Oh, I thought this was the story of, like, you got, like, now let's go do this, and let's take that, and you were like...
Well, she showed me downtown...
That's what I meant. She was taking you around.
Right. I met her at one bar, and then we went to two other bars, you know, and I bought drinks at the bars, and she knew the bartenders.
So do you still wonder if she was a working girl, or she thought, I got a guy from out of town, got some cash, and I'll just let him buy me drinks all night?
One of the two.
And you're thinking, I'm hoping it was just the buy me drinks and show me around.
You know, I really didn't. I was just pleased that a younger, beautiful woman would care to spend an hour with me. And it probably seemed longer because I was like, I don't normally drink, but when I go on vacation, well, I don't normally, whatever. I mean, when I'm working, I try to abstain from the alcohol. It's got me in trouble. I battled that thing, whatever. And, you know, but sometimes you go on vacation, and it's like, well, you know, I'm going to go out and drink tonight. I've been working hard, scouting locations, checking out the scene. Let's go out and have a couple drinks tonight.
And the next thing you know, you wake up in a hotel room.
I stayed in my own hotel room, and it was at the D, and it used to be called Fitzgerald's. But that place, they're trying to revitalize.
Oh, Fitzgerald's, yeah. They're going to redo that whole thing. I think that's where there was some... Is that where Vince Neil had his tattoo parlor there? I think so. I can't remember.
You know, I'm not sure, but it didn't have the best of reputations, the Fitzgerald. And maybe it still doesn't amongst people. I stayed there because it was inexpensive. I mean, I think I stayed there for 5 nights, and the average price per stay was per night was under $40 or maybe $40. And it's more expensive on the weekend, but whatever, Expedia.com. But they are trying to redo their image, so they changed.
So they had you in.
I was just, and you know, the room was fine. I mean, you know, I read some, you know, like reviews and things that people like, oh, it's loud, and it's like, you know, like.
Put me next to the elevator.
I sleep in my car once in a while. The room was plenty nice for me.
It had a bed. Yippee!
Had a bed. And the rooms were all, what? They were all redone. New
mattresses?
Yes, the whole, I mean,
you hope it was new mattresses. Well, probably because they found a dead hooker under it and they had to change the bed.
I don't know for sure about the mattresses, but the linens and the, what do you call it, the comforters and everything and the furniture, all the rooms have been redone at the D.
Which
used to be Fitzgerald's.
Yeah. Well, after all these years of traveling and Vegas-like stories, what would you say is your most bizarre road story ever? What, when you look back, you're like, holy man.
Bizarre. I don't know about bizarre. I mean, sometimes you want to go to the story where it involves sex and women trying to pick you up. Or then there's bizarre as far as one of the worst shows I've ever had. I don't know. You know.
What's your best road story then?
But, you
what
know,
would you be?
You know, like, here's the hardest show I did, I think, was at the Buffalo Chip. My first year there, back in 2009, the year Steven Tyler fell off the stage at the Buffalo Chip. I was all excited when I got there. I thought this was going to be my big career break. I had a couple of spots on the main stage. I was going to be doing comedy on the secondary stages. And I had assumed that doing comedy out there, there was not only as the main stage of the Buffalo Chip, but there's three secondary stages where bands start playing in the afternoon. I assumed there was always going to be people partying and hanging around. And so my idea was, let me go up between bands and...
keep their attention kind of deal.
And I thought, you know, I got to say something funny. And I would do a quick joke. Anyway, that was my idea. But when I got out there, there's nobody on these secondary stages in the afternoon. And so I had to search for an audience. And one of the places that they thought would be good for me was to follow a bikini contest. And hosting the bikini contest, Hedonism 2, the all-inclusive resort in Jamaica, was one of the sponsors that year. And they had their two entertainment guys there. And these guys are professional showmen, MCs. They work at Hedonism 2. This is where you take your clothes off. Swingers and shit go there. Oh. They've got these games that they play where they try to get people naked on stage. And you can't get naked at the Buffalo Chip, but it's like most sex acts mimed in like 30 seconds is one of the. And they don't bring up couples. They bring up two different people from the crowd. So they jump around and doggy style and horsey and this, you know, I mean, like that. And the audience counts down. And they're getting the audience just worked up into a frenzy. Then they bring out the bikini. The ladies from the bikini contest was the plan. But somebody got the idea that between the sex games and the bikini contest was going to be me, which is hard enough in the first place. But somehow they didn't get this idea. So they're doing this. They're doing this. whipping the audience in this frenzy after this audience participation sex games. And now this guy, they're playing reggae music in the background. And now, are you ready to meet the lovely ladies of the bikini contest? Are you ready to meet the lovely contestants? And then the stage manager goes out and says something to his ear and goes, oh, wait, but first we have a comedian.
Oh, it was like putting the brakes on.
And you could, a collective loud gasp came from the crowd. Oh, and then I went out there, and that was my first real show at the Buffalo Chip.
Okay, and how did the first joke go out? When the first one goes out, how was it?
You know what? I don't remember. I remember that was one of my best sets at the rally that year. Partly was fear, partly because it was a weekend crowd where they were like, well, they kind of felt probably sorry for me or something. And, you know, it went okay. That being said, I had to do that show every day for the rest of the rally.
The same bikini show, now a comic, kind of?
Yeah, and they had it figured out where they didn't have that awkward thing where the bikini contest was starting, but these guys were doing their little games and things, and then they brought me up. And I was supposed to do, I know one thing though, I was supposed to do 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do 20 minutes.
What'd you do?
Maybe 7.
Oh, shit.
10 probably. You know, like, I mean, I could sense, like, you know, they're going to tolerate me for a little bit. A
little bit, but they're not going to go the full, and somebody's going to throw a beer can at me.
They want to see titties. You can't compete with titties. I wish I had a woman on stage. Every time a joke bombed, she'd flash the audience. Of course, then they would want the jokes to bomb.
Bomb, yeah. That sucked. Even that starts to laugh. No, don't laugh.
And I guess the most, and you know, speaking of Buffalo Chip, you know, the biggest thrill I had was I got to go up on stage between bands on the main stage between Tesla and Hinder. And I guesstimate there was probably 15,000 people out there. It was being on stage for a rock and roll concert. And this was kind of my big break. And I thought, if I can, you know, this crowd loves me and they'll have me back and do this again, this could make my career. And, you know, I get brought up on stage and I've not done a sound check. There's roadies working around me, you know, taking care of, you know, setting up the next band. And I'm not standing in front of a monitor. And there is 15,000 bikers out there who don't give a shit that there's a comic out there. So I am doing my best to tell my best dick jokes, you know, and jokes that I think that they'll like, and I'm like,
are you projecting harder at this point? Are you doing the can it?
You nailed it. Projecting harder, too hard. So, the owner of the Buffalo Chip, Rod Woodruff, Woody, he was there with me backstage. He wished me well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, what do you think? He goes, I thought it was too short, and I thought you were too loud. Well, at least he didn't think I went too long. And but turns out that, you know, I was, you don't need to speak very loudly on a microphone at a rock concert.
No.
And
so you were being louder and into a microphone.
And it was just annoying everybody in the, and, you know, it didn't go horribly bad. But you know what? Talk about live and learning. You don't get another chance to go out and perform for 15,000 people in between Tesla and Hinder again. Well, let me do that over again tomorrow night.
Did somebody videotape it? Did you get it? Because that'd be something you would love to see a set like that in front of that many people. Didn't the Buffalo Chip have their own cameras going? Or
they might have destroyed the tape. You know, it must be someplace. And there, you know, if you get the official video of the Buffalo Chip, and I don't know who does it, they've got, you know, segments. Short segments of me, but you know, I've never, it sounds stupid, but I've never bothered to get it because.
Are you going
to
do this again?
Well, I won't be on the main stage. I don't think that, you know, I would love to get back there someday. My goal to have a comedy special film there, and I think if you get the audience, you know, the Buffalo Chip people behind you, it could go well. Cheech and Chong's been out there, Williams and Rhea have been out there. You know, there has been some comedy done. Sam Kinison was there once before. But, yeah, I'm going back again this year, and I don't know exactly where the comedy's going to be done. I would do a show in the afternoon on the Sam Kinison stage, and then last year...
Oh, there's a stage, actually, called the Sam Kinison stage?
Yes. He performed back there at one time. And there's a story about him being there that I was talking to somebody who was at that show, and Sam was not doing well.
Oh.
And he was bitching at the... at the audience. I don't know if they were paying attention. I don't know if they cared. But this is back in the day when it was wild. And when Miss Buffalo Chip was the wet t-shirt contest, you know, they would show skin. And there's stories about throwing, you know, objects that disappeared up there. I don't know if those are true or not. But anyway, it was back in the wild day. And Sam's out there doing his set. And it's not, I mean, maybe it's not going bad, but, it's, you know, anyway. But he looked out there, and there was a woman on some guy's shoulder, you know, like you would have at a concert when she's trying to get a better view.
Yeah.
But this chick was not facing the stage. She was faced the other way, and she was obviously writhing in a way that let him realize that she's getting eaten out.
During his set.
Yeah. And
people wonder what goes on at Sturgeon.
And he, oh my God, look at that. And, you know, he just went off on this. And the crowd just, of course, just loved it. And, well, then he got the crowd on his side.
He saved the show.
That's the story.
Yeah.
Thanks to the woman getting her eaten out at the, yeah. And there are those swinger kind of people and stuff. But, you know, mostly they're just, you know, just regular folks that, you know, the bikers that work at
Do you feel like that's what was your crowd? I mean, did you feel like you're a biker yourself, so you would fit in, or you just think that I sort of look like this, so they might accept me? What was your Or have you changed your look more to fit them?
Well, I don't think that I'm a biker, number one, and I think the most important thing you want to do is you want to let the bikers know that you're not a pretender wannabe. There's nothing worse. And I was hoping they would accept me anyway. I thought the reason I only even got this idea is because I had done two motorcycle rally events before, the 100th anniversary Harley-Davidson in Milwaukee, and I did the Four Corners Iron Horse Motorcycle Rally in Southern Colorado. But those shows went well. That kind of gave me the idea, but I kind of thought the bikers would just like my style of comedy. I was having sex the other night with my girlfriend. She was complaining that it only lasted a minute. I said, yeah, but we were doing it doggy style. That would make it like 7. You know, jokes like that, like, hey, say something funny, you know, and then, never forget a face, wish I could, fuck some ugly women. You know, I mean, just, you know, like, oh, that is pretty funny. So I thought that I could work that big outdoor event, you know, that's one of, because I do those quick jokes.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the kind of brand that they would, you know, and plus I do sort of look like a biker, but I did have to change my look because the first year I used to wear black jeans and a black t-shirt, and I thought that looked too much biker like. What, do you want to be a biker? So it's a long story, but I now look more like a mechanic. It's got that blue collar look. I wear a backwards hat, and I look more like a mechanic than I do a biker. But I'm hoping these guys accept me, and you know, I think they can tell I'm not a biker. I don't do any biker material.
You've never written stuff specifically for, like, biker that you go, oh, this is perfect for the rally?
Well, I'm always working on biker-friendly jokes, but those are jokes like, that I think bikers will like.
What would be a few of your, like, you consider your bike, this would be your biker-friendly jokes?
My girlfriend can't hold down a job, throws up every time I make her swallow. That's one that they seem to like. You know, guys claim there's no such thing as bad oral sex. Well, that's bullshit, and I got the scar to prove it. Stuff like that. I love having my balls tickled while getting a blowjob, which is why I'm so turned on by women with facial hair. How about that one? So, you know, they're this like, and you know, these good old boys, they don't want to hear some long old story. They do like a good joke. And so you just try to give them, you know, good jokes. And, so that's what I try to do, pack as many good jokes as I can into the tightest period. And it's also, it's kind of like, you know, they're challenging, like.
Right. I can say that you, from working with you, you have, that would not be your regular set at a comedy club. You do, you know, there's the biker set and then you have your club set. So people that might hear this go, oh, is that what he does? No, he actually, that's your biker set. That's why I was asking, you know, like. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, and you know it's not 180 degrees different, but it's just it's take out the clean jokes and insert the dirty jokes. You gotta still have some clean jokes in there, but I'll take out a joke like I have a friend who's a dyslexic paranoid. He always thinks that he's following somebody. That's not in my biker rally set. There's a magic shop near where I live. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. That's not in the rally set, you know.
Yeah.
It's a steady dose of, you know, and you still have to have some clean jokes in the mix, because if they're all jokes about blowjobs, you see that the blowjob punchline's coming.
Right.
So, you know, you got to mix it up a little bit, but it's compacted drug, drinking, and dick.
Yeah, and I can see where your that one joke you do about suggesting that your girlfriend get implants can go either way on either show, right?
Oh, I have some jokes that sometimes the crowd, you know, ooh, they don't like, or they're offended. Like trying to talk my girlfriend into getting implants, at the very least some kind of dentures.
See? A great twist. Uh-huh. And the, as you can see at the biker rally, they're like, yeah.
You know, here's something funny about doing jokes. You know, you have to kind of adjust to the rally, because there were certain jokes I thought would work great. But some jokes, you know, like, there's this culture in the motorcycle rally where show us your tits, or, you know, like, you know, that's all great. And there's a kind of the swinger kind of thing. But then they do not like you to disrespect women. They hold women in. I like a joke that works. I mean, I did this joke. I do it at the end of my show, and I tell people it's from my book, and this is jokes that are too sick for the stage. And so I don't. I do it at the end of the show, and I ask the audience permission for me to do some sick jokes.
Right.
And one that I do there that I thought they would love at the motorcycle rally was, I just hate a woman with a big mouth. Makes my dick look small. The crowd's like, what? You can't talk about your woman like that. Like, I could just feel like, oh, are you kidding me? I thought that was my opener out here. And another joke they just hated was, I was at a strip club the other night, and there was this dancer, had the most incredibly large set of knockers on her, but you could tell they were fake. You could see her dick. Ooh, don't do anything like that out there. Like, they're, I don't know if you'd call it homophobic, but they don't need.
They didn't go for that one? I would think that'd be right up the, straight up the alley there.
You know, I'm not going to say I will never do that joke out there again, but I got the sense that don't go to the gay references. You know what I mean? Sometimes you want to do that in your act, like, you know, like the joke I do about, anyway, it doesn't, well, but anyway, yeah, they don't, I don't throw in those tags. Well, I do the joke that I had a date once with a woman cop. Of course, I had no idea she was a cop. She was dressed up like a prostitute. So anyway, when she first slapped the handcuffs on, I'm thinking, oh, shit, this is going to cost extra. Then a bunch of guys rushed in and wrestled me to the ground. Imagine my relief when I found that I was just being arrested. That's normally, that's where it ends at the motorcycle rally. Uh-huh. But normally in a show, I'll add, oh, shit, I can't afford all this. I'll put that
tag. That's a good tag, yeah.
You know, but I'll leave that homo tag off. Homo? Is that a right word to say? Maybe that's offensive. The gay tag.
Are you not being politically correct? See, do you see how we're all thinking, how political correctness is changing our minds of what, like, you can't say that, is that a good punchline? Am I allowed? You know, shouldn't we just be, we just say stuff and let it slide off if you don't like it, and...
Yeah, maybe. I understand. It does affect you, and I'm uncomfortable by that whole thing about whether you're self-censoring yourself, whether you should care. But I guess you got to be... I mean, there are certain jokes that I will not do, like, oh, that's just wrong. I can't do that joke.
But you wrote it.
Yeah.
You thought it.
You know. So
are those in the book more from the vile file?
Some of them are, and some of them I had to leave out. You know?
What? Because, jokes so wrong you left them out of...
Well, you know, I mean, I purposely left. There was just some jokes that were just wrong. But then, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, there was a few jokes that I left out just because the punchline was that I'm gay and that's a bad thing. And I decided to leave. That's the gay bashing jokes. I decided to leave those out. And I had some good, you know, like, jokes that had a racial element in them. And that doesn't seem to be right to leave those in. So there were some, you know, I will. So your question, should I think it's bullshit that you got to worry about being PC, but in a real world, you do worry about hurting certain people's feelings. Here's a joke that I did one time.
Okay.
I was at one of the loony bins as a feature act, and I probably shouldn't have done this joke. It didn't stay in my act very long, but my whole family was relieved when my brother got the electric chair. Now we don't have to worry about pushing his handicapped ass around anymore. And there was a handicapped person in the show that night, and she took offense at that. And she got up to leave.
Did she really get up, or did she just roll out?
But that took forever because she wasn't in a wheelchair. She was in some kind of crutches, so it took her a long time to walk out. And everybody could see she was walking out. And I didn't really think that. I didn't, you know, to me, I didn't think I was making fun of somebody being handicapped. I was making, there was a pun, was on electric chair. And plus, it's a good thing to get someone an electric chair. And I didn't say, if I said crippled ass, there's worthless crippled ass around anymore. I didn't realize it was offensive. It was. I stopped doing it. But anyway, here's the great part. Ben Creed was headlining then. It was at the Funny Bone, or it was at the Looney Bin Memphis. And I went back to the condo. I was so, I never had anybody walk
you
out
felt
the show.
Bad? Like,
well, she was yelling at me all the way out. It was a scene. And I went back to the condo, didn't watch the rest of the show, and Ben came back. He goes, that lady came back in. She just loved the show. She was hitting on me afterwards. She says, you know what? And she told Ben this. She goes, you know, you could fuck me in the ass. I wouldn't feel it anyway. So obviously she had a sense of humor.
But she just got offended by you.
She got offended by me. So, you know, but you do, as a comic, you do worry about what certain people are going to think. And I don't know.
I don't. I know that's bad. I really, you've seen my act. I don't really, I have no filter when I'm, that's why I was always weirded out, strange to me that I could adjust between radio and stand-up. It's like my brain goes, you don't say these things on the radio.
Interesting.
But yet I go on stage and, you know, I don't give a shit if I offend anybody.
You know, you would really, you could not do your comedy act on the radio, but you're one of those guys, we were talking about this before we started taping about, we were talking about guys that can say things to women and not offend them. But for some reason, you know, and that's the strength of the Steve McGrew mudflap character, is that the audience understands you're just joking. And you can say things and get away with it where other comics are not able to. And, you know, for any, some people go, oh, yeah, comics are all dirty like a guy like me. Oh, he just has a bunch of dick jokes. Oh, really? Well, you know what? You try to be dirty. There's nothing worse than trying to listen to some act who's not funny and tries to be dirty.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It's just disgusting. It's just, you're just cussing and saying stuff just to be shocking. Where I just work unfiltered. Like, you know, most of my act isn't dirty. Like, you know,
no.
When we talk about all the just
or offensive.
Stuff, or offensive. But yet every once in a while, I'll drop into one of those, what did he just say?
Yeah, where some people are like, oh, that's, you can't say that about how you treat children or whatever. But, you know, but you're also, where you come from it is, you know, there's some comics that they're, you're not, you say politically incorrect things sometimes, but you're not trying to get a reaction from the crowd by saying something politically incorrect. You just kind of, it's just part of your bit. You come there. There's certain comics that just want to offend.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think that's another reason why you can get away with it.
Do you think
you're
a lot
able
of the
to
new,
get away with it.
Do you think a lot of the new comics are like that? That they're just into the, who can we piss off? Who can we offend?
That's edgy. Yeah, I think they think that's, you know, speaking truth to power and being edgy and whatever. I think that they're in just, yeah, the sake of being mean or cruel, you know, for the sake of being mean or cruel, or it seems to be a lot of the alternative comedy scene is pointing out how stupid people are, or how unhip they are, and how enlightened they are.
Yeah.
And you know what?
If a joke doesn't make the entire room laugh, it's not a good joke. That's the way I always think it. If I can't make the entire room laugh, I don't want to just be like, oh, I was hip enough that those six got it.
Right.
You know?
I remember one time, a younger comic told me, he said, yeah, I like to play the back of the room. I go, yeah? I like to play the entire room.
Exactly.
And that's the one thing where, you know, like we're both old school in the regard that we believe in a polished act where you want the audience to be, like last night you said, some lady was going, stop it, I can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had people tell me afterwards, you know, my gut hurt for the next day from laughing so hard. That's what we're, you know, aiming for. I'm not trying to make a point. And some of these new comics, and you know, it's fine if that's what they want to do. I'm not the comedy police. I'm not criticizing, but it's not what I enjoy watching or what I want to be. But you know, they don't mind long pauses, or to take them a long time to get to a punchline.
Audience is mine, or at least a lot of the ones that the comedy clubs mind. Is it the new rooms that don't? Is it these hip rooms that are popping up that you can just go in there and it's almost like those old. Remember the old beatnik kind of?
Yeah.
Where you can just stand there and I'll just talk.
I don't know. And, you know, maybe these guys are, I don't know. Maybe I'm just a bitter old guy. But, you know, I just, it seems to me that, you know, like punchline, you know, set up punchline, set up punchline, set up punchline, set up punchline. Thank you. Good night. You know, and I mean, if
you. Well, that's for you. But, like, for me, I love to riff and improv a lot. I have an idea. But I think I work quick enough that there is a punchline or a visual image that's funny.
You know, and I maybe I said it wrong, punchline, but
that's for me. I'm talking, your act is like
but,
that.
But no, but if I'm trying to make that we're similar in the regard that I do set up punchline to get a laugh, but it's riding that waves of laughter, bang, 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 whether you call it a punchline or whatever, there you know where the laughs are coming from. Or where they're supposed to be, you know, and you know you could turn down even if you didn't understand English, you could get that you have a sense of timing and a pacing or whatever that lends itself. It's a polished act where there's consistent waves of laughter, and that's the way I like to see comedy done.
I appreciate the comment there.
Yeah, you destroyed that room, especially that first show last night. People were coming out, and, you know, they were still, you can tell when they leave the room, and people are buzzing and talking and all excited, and they're like, oh, that was great. And they're all talking about the show on the way out.
That's good. I've gotten better. I used to hide after shows. I really did. I would just do my thing, and then go and hide in the dressing room, not really go out and shake hands or take pictures. I know a lot of comics go out and meet everybody, and they're taking pictures for their Facebook page. But I always felt like, you know, I hope you enjoyed what I did, you know, and I don't want to go out there and say the wrong thing or offend you in some way or, you know. Does that make any sense?
That's hysterical. I mean, I definitely wanted to hide until I started selling my book after the show. And then it was fun because I was making money and I was poor. But yeah, I understand that sense. It's so funny that, you know, because you are so confident on stage, to hear that is amusing. But, you know, Johnny Carson was that way. You know, he was not, you know, he did not want to talk to people after the show, and he was shy that way. But there's so many comics that, you know, that in order to be in this business, they want that adulation. And they, I mean, there's plenty of guys that stand by the exit door
And shake everybody's hand.
And, you know, they need to hear, again, it wasn't enough for them to get the laugh. They need to hear from everybody on the way, oh, you were great. Did you enjoy the show? Who's going to say no?
Right, right. Well, it's the same guys. I'm very introverted off stage, sort of. I don't really, if we go to parties, my girlfriend even says to me, we don't have to go. I know you don't like parties. I don't like being, you know, like I might be put on the spot. Do you ever feel, you're like, whoa, you're a comic? You know what I mean? Like, well, we hung out with him, and I didn't think he was funny. You know what I mean? Well, that's not what I do. So I'd rather just be, you know, I'll go be alone, and then you come see me do what I do. Because I really sometimes feel very Jekyll and Hyde. Like, what happens on stage is what my brain would really like to be doing.
I can empathize with that completely. I live back in my hometown now, and people, they won't go to see my show. They don't think I'm funny. They're like, you're a comedian, you're not even funny. And, you know, they judge me by, you know, by how I watch the football game. I don't understand why they get this idea. I don't, you know, they have these stupid expectations, or they think, oh, you think you're better than us? Oh, you think you're a comedian? So, yeah, I would rather people, what do you do for a living?
I sell insurance, and then they leave you alone.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's great.
I sell insurance.
I got to steal that. I go, oh, it's complicated. What? And then I guess all that does is beg more questions.
Right, yeah.
Insurance.
Yeah.
I'm an Amway salesman.
Well, who is your favorite new comic?
Boy, I don't know if I have a favorite new comic. I know one guy I'm a little bit envious of. He's kind of having the career that I thought I was supposed to have, was Anthony Jeselnik. He writes a lot of dark jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a career writing and performing. He did that Charlie Sheen roast, was it? And I saw him right after he did that in Minneapolis. And he's funny. I don't think he has... I wasn't blown away yet. And he's very funny. His character's great. You know, but he's got a slower pacing.
Yeah,
you know,
and a very nice guy too.
He seems smart, and you know, I heard him on the pod. I was very jealous of the guy just because, I mean, you know, I'm much older now, but you know, I mean, that's what I was. He's kind of taking the career path that I was hoping that this guy writes good stuff, and he's able to get away with the dark stuff because he writes good stuff, and you know, he's gotten breaks in the audience,
and he doesn't look like a serial killer.
Well, maybe that's it. But I listened to the podcast with Mark Maron. He came up as you know, well-spoken, nice guy, and a good student of the craft, and he's good.
So you listen to Mark's podcast?
I do, and I really loved it there for a while. I'm listening to it less now because, I mean, I really liked the comics when he had on, but now he's got just kind of like, you know, kind of celebrity people.
It's almost like a paid publicist. I need my publicist to get me on that show kind of deal.
Yeah, maybe he's just run out of... comics, and the show is becoming popular, and I guess, you know, people, you want to, I don't know how he books the show, but I mean, the success is, I mean,
it's amazing, the success that it's had. Who are some of the other podcasts that you like and listen to?
Well, I don't really listen to many podcasts. I try to listen to Adam Carolla's once in a while, Jay Moore's once in a while, Bill Burr's once in a while.
Do you like Bill's?
He can be a little bit too opinionated.
So, but isn't that what we do? I mean, part of what we get when we get on stage, you write for, or at least myself, and you probably do too, I write from a personal perspective. You know, that's what makes you good on radio or whatever, is this is me.
Yeah, you know, and I don't listen. I've only listened to these, you know, on my Stitcher. You know, I'll pull up the comedy podcast.
Love Stitcher.
The only one I got on my app phone is the WTF podcast, and I really don't have that much time to listen to that many of them, so I really can't give an honest opinion. I just, you know, Bill Burr will always be a hero of mine from that rant he did for the Opie and Anthony show in Philadelphia.
That is the ultimate comedy experience. That when he turns and just attacks the audience, it's amazing. If anybody's out there, Google Bill Burr, Opie and Anthony, Philadelphia. Put those keywords in and be amazed at what Bill does. Bill is in the new movie Stand Up Guys with Christopher Walken and Al Pacino.
I have not heard of this.
Yeah, it just came out this weekend. He's in it. He plays a bad hitman kind of guy. And I was surprised. Like, oh, that's Bill Burr.
Well, good for him.
And he's in a movie with Walken and Pacino. How can you... Wouldn't you be shitting in your pants if that was your role? Like, I do believe it's his first role. If not, I apologize. But if that's your first movie role and you've got to do a scene with Pacino and Walken?
I will not be afraid to admit that that would be... I could... If I did that, I could die a happy man.
Right there.
Yeah, I mean, I think almost all comics... I mean, you know, you have for me, it's probably a secret fantasy. You know, I always thought that because I was playing this weird, wacky character that I would get weird and wacky acting parts.
Oh, you would think it would just come for you. I mean, like, you are a character, a casting agent should go, he'd be perfect for...
You know, and just that movie where you don't have that many lines. You know, that'd be great. But, you know, anyway, I would love to be an actor. And, you know, you would be, you know, you hear... That's one of the great things about these podcasts is you hear people that are, you know, like, that are... You know, living the dream that you know, and they're actually, and what it would be like to be on set with, you know, I met one guy one time who was on set with Russell Crowe, and I don't even remember what the story was, but it was just him telling it like, really? You know,
it's Russell Crowe.
It was kind of Russell being a dick, you know, like, hey, we're going to, everybody's going out to eat. What? The fact that, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to bother you, Mr. Crowe.
You didn't mean to invite you.
But just the fact that he was talking about, you know, like, you know, and his story didn't even mean anything because it was like this brief encounter. And I'm all excited because this guy's talking about actually meeting Russell
Crowe. Who's the most famous person you've ever met?
I don't know. I used to know Tommy Chong. I guess he's pretty famous. I've never really met any super famous people. A friend of mine, Nick Swardson, he's from Minneapolis. I watched him come up. He's pretty damn famous.
Yeah. And y'all are friends.
Well, you know, we don't chat on the phone, but Nick is a super guy. I would call him a friend. I think he would say that I'm a friend of his. I know I've been out to the Improv before and on Melrose there in Hollywood or wherever it is. And I go to order a drink, and the bartender goes, Nick told me to put all your drinks on his tab.
Nice. So that is really a friend. You could probably call Nick a friend.
We're Facebook friends.
There you go.
Yes, you know, I remember once in a while I'll get an email from him or something, and I mean, if I see a movie, I remember I sent him an email for I saw Don't Mess with the Zohan, and I said, I just saw Zohan. I gotta say that was the absolute stupidest movie I've ever seen, and of course I mean that as the greatest compliment, because you know, I mean, it was just bizarrely, I mean.
Almost as bad as Bucky whatever.
Well, I didn't see... You know, I have not seen that one yet, and I was busy at the time. I want to see that. I'm not saying that Zohan was bad. I mean, it's not necessarily my style of movie. I meant that when I sent that to Nick. I meant that as a compliment, by the way, because it was just, you know, ridiculous. I meant bad in a kind of... I didn't even say bad. The comedy was just over the top ridiculous. I'm not going to bash a friend's movie on a podcast, even if he's never going to hear it. I love Zohan, and I'm sure I'll love Bucky when I see it, even though it got bad reviews. Nick Swartzen's a friend. I'm not going to... Yeah.
All right, there you go. I wasn't trying to trap you on the podcast. I was just trying to see if you'd ever seen what has been claimed to be one of the worst movies ever, and I haven't seen it either.
I did. I was sitting with Nick when he told me the story about the first star-rolling movie he was going to be in. We were at Acme. That's his home club. And he told me that Adam had called him one day and had this idea for a movie about a kid from the Midwest. Finding out his parents were in porn stars, and he went out to Hollywood or L.A. or whatever to follow their footsteps. And I thought to myself, sounds like an Adam Sandler movie.
Good luck with that.
And, well, it was pretty exciting to hear, you know, to hear these stories from the guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the fact that, you know, you kind of get some goosebumps when, you know, Nick's just telling you, a matter of fact, that you know, he was on the phone with Adam Sandler. So, I mean, yeah, it was cool. I mean, who knows how these movies are going to turn out? I mean, I usually prefer to watch a documentary than a silly, you know, comedy movie.
Do you have an idea for a movie?
I have a couple. Yeah, I've written a couple of screenplays. I wrote a Christmas play. I wrote a Christmas movie once, and I got this new idea. I just formulated it last week, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, don't want to share it yet.
No, I don't think it's good to share, because not only can somebody else steal the idea, more likely somebody will go, "That's stupid," and ruin your enthusiasm for it. Or the superstitious, you don't want to jinx yourself.
Right. Yeah, how many times in this business have you gone like, someone just called me and I'm gonna get a chance to be in this, or I got an offer to do this gig, and the people are like, well, what happened? It didn't come through. I got this agent that's looking at me, and what happened? It didn't come through.
My grandfather would say, you know, don't talk about something that's gonna happen. Tell me about it when it's happened. Something like that.
Yeah, that makes more sense. But, you know, in this day and age of social media and everything, everybody's trying to create their own buzz. You know what I mean? They're trying to create, I'm talking to, and I just got asked to, you know, all that gets tweeted out and Facebooked, and hoping that you're creating this, you know, this buzz about you. You're going to be a big act.
That's why I'm doing the podcast.
That's exactly why I do the podcast.
I got an idea now. You asked about a movie. I do have an idea for a screenplay, but I'm writing I think it's going to be a screenplay within my novel. And my novel, I worked on it very hard for about several months, a couple of years ago. And I got to get back to it full time. But this, I'll tell you about this. This is my idea. It's about a bitter, aging, homeless comic who snaps. And the movie was and I was gonna write I was gonna I had this idea, but then when I started writing the novel, I'm going, you know, it's really hard to write a novel about a character who's a serial killer. This isn't gonna work. So
it's hard to feel like any empathy for the character.
And I didn't want to write that, so it went a different direction. But here was my original idea. It was loosely based on my stand-up character, you know. And the idea was that I did a show in a big city, and I was the show bombed. I went and hung out under I went and got drunk someplace, ran into some homeless guy. Oh no, wait a minute! I freaking messed this up. Doesn't matter. Anyway, the point of the story is that. A bitter, aging homeless comic who snaps. He meets a homeless guy who looks exactly like him, but he's homeless because he's crazy. And he also has that photographic memory thing. So he comes out to see his show. He hears this guy that looks just like him. He finds him, brings him to the show. They go and they're drinking with their buddies around the barrel after the show. And he's doing my act around the other homeless guys around the drinking barrel. And everybody's laughing. He realizes this guy could fill in for me while I go on a cross-country killing spree and take down every backstabbing comedy booker and people have done me wrong in the business. And while this guy would fill in for me, the problem and the twist of the story is that this guy's funnier. Even though he's doing the exact same act and looks exactly like me, he's got the whatever it is.
Whatever it takes, the timing is better or whatever.
I think it's the likability of you know, or something like that. I don't think the timing was off, but that could be part of the story. But then the switch has got to be that, you know, now I got to take that guy out because life back.
Gallagher 2 on a killing spree.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, but there's so many real life stories you can put in there, because, you know, there's been so many times you've been done wrong in this business, and there's, you know, I mean, and it would be easy to make the agents as, you know, people that that you could feel good about.
Yeah.
not any real life, but with an exaggeration as a comedy, right. As a dark comedy.
Yeah, years ago I had an idea for a movie with comedy in mind where there was murders happening all across the country, just murders, and they couldn't figure out a tie-in. Because, you know, most murders have a tie-in. There's a clue, or there's something. How are they? But these are randomly cities all around the... And it was just a comic that could go around. And there was, you know, randomly he's booked in Minneapolis. He booked in, you know.
Isn't that how they found a rapist once?
I think so.
Yeah, was it? forgot what that guy's name was.
Me too, but I was on Star Search with him. Yeah, and when that happened...
I'm not laughing. You shouldn't laugh about Ray.
No, you should not. You should not.
I'm not laughing about that, but I'm talking about how this guy thought he had the perfect thing to get caught. And he's in prison
still. Yeah, and when that happened, they would show clips of him on the news, and I was in the pictures. And I hope they could tell who was who.
Right. The Star Search people. Yeah. Oh, that's not...
You know, former Star Search comedian, arrested for... Oh, no, not me. The other guy.
You know, there's a Dwight York serving time in a federal penitentiary. He's like the Black David Koresh. So if you Google my name, mm-hmm. he has a different name. It's like Malaki something or other. He's got some Muslim sounding name. He was some like, I don't know what. But anyway.
But his real name is Dwight York?
It is. And so you Google that and people are like, hey, did you see? I've heard this a lot. But no, don't get me confused with that. My daughter was in college in Atlanta, Georgia, and his name was splashed over the headlines. Dwight York, isn't that your dad? No.
No.
But yeah, he's in prison for a child. Right? He had child brides.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of, we'll spin off from the child thing. Younger.
Good.
What would be the advice that you would give, or what would you say to young comics? What's the one thing that you think young comics need to do?
If you're doing an open stage before a real comedy show, be sure to stick around and watch the comics that are in the show.
That bothers you, doesn't it?
It sort of bothers me. But what the advice that I'm really given, I was trying to make a joke of that because that happened the other night. And it's happened to me several times that I've done comedy where I'm just amazed that the open stage comics aren't watching the show.
Oh, I know. We've talked about this before. When you and I started, you watched every show. You wanted to see how it was done. You wanted to learn. You wanted to see the timing. How did they handle the crowd? And I see a lot of the comics... They come in, do their 5 minutes that they've done over and over and over, and then they walk out, put their jackets on, and leave.
Yeah, or sit out in the bar and chat with their friends while the show's going on. And you know what? And there's two reasons that, I watch their show. And you know what? Even by watching somebody who's brand new, I'm learning something. I don't know what I'm learning, but but anytime you're in that showroom, what advice that I have is see as much comedy as you possibly can, write as much as you possibly can, and get on stage as much as you possibly can. It's that simple. And then try to be, and don't try to copy anybody.
How much do you see that on the new talent? You can almost pick out, he's doing Mitch Hedberg, he's doing Hicks, he's doing Stan Hope's timing and delivery.
It's got to be too much, and I guess we're all influenced by those that go before us. I mean, I'm sure that I'm influenced by Stephen Wright and George Carlin and people. Some people ask me if I'm influenced by Mitch Hedberg. Hey, we started at the same time. I don't know if that was possible timing wise, but maybe we were influenced by the same people.
Jokes are different. Your timing is different. Right. You're just a one liner comic.
We're just both non sequitur.
Yeah,
one-liners. That's the only similarity. But anyway, but people will come up there because they're not... Some of the younger people, that's one thing that's coming full circle is that I'm kind of old school and some people are like, oh, joke, whatever. If you hate jokes, whatever.
What are you at a comedy club?
That's why I like to start my show. Hope you like jokes. But there's some younger people that, didn't grow up with the one-liner guys, or they're not familiar with somebody like Rodney Dangerfield was probably a big influence on me. He's one of my favorite comics. Always another joke coming. Bust a character thing, your self-deprecating humor, but they're not familiar with acts like that. So when they see me, they've never seen anything like it. It's like I'm brand new.
That's pretty cool, though. And it's almost like you have reinvented yourself.
If you stick around or if you keep a tie long enough, it'll come in fashion again.
Right. You're not a hoarder. You're just waiting for it to come back in style.
I was retro. Now I'm...
Yeah. Well, I think you've come back in style. I mean, the 2 weeks that I've worked with you have been great. And, my suggestion is any club that is thinking about hiring Dwight York ought to hire Dwight York. Is that a good suggestion?
I think it's good. And who knew that I could host a show? Sometimes I headline, but, Jeff Jones asked me to do this week because he knew I liked working with you. And the reason I like working with Steve McGrew, by the way, is because no matter how well I do in front of him, he's going to do great. even better, I'll say, but the show is going to be fantastic. He's not going to complain about, oh, that guy in front of me was doing a bunch of dick jokes or whatever. You know, you set the bar high, he takes it even higher. So it's fun to work with somebody like that. You don't have to feel bad about doing too well in that middle spot. But that being said, who would have knew that I could host a show? A lot of times people don't want to work with me because, oh, he can't host, and because I do the weird character. But yeah. I'm going up there, and I'm starting to show off cold.
And I can see that you love it, too. I've been watching you. You've actually, you're smiling now when you get up there, like, it's the Dwight York Show. Let's start this thing off right. And, you know, you do have you're in character a little bit when you're hosting, you know, coming up. I want to make a couple of the announcements. And make sure you tip your waitress. You know, you've got you're doing your delivery. It starts off right and keeps the show going.
That's organic. I mean, I don't realize I'm doing that way. I'm just, but there's two reasons I like doing it, because it's kind of fun, actually, you know, because, you know, you say something, you know, hey, round of applause here, you ready to do this, you know, the crowd, you're getting the crowd up. But the fact that I think my future holds it, I'm going to have to do some shows myself. If I ever get that show out in Las Vegas, you know.
You're going to have to, hey, good evening, everybody.
I'm thinking it's a one-person show, you know. And then if I do more motorcycle rallies, I'm also doing a tattoo convention coming up. You know, it's things that I have to do myself. Yeah. And when I've been doing the Buffalo Chip, you know, I brought out other acts to open for me, but it was always a freaking train wreck.
Yeah.
And I could never know what I could depend on. And, you know, so I decided last year I'd do it myself. And, you know, Donnie Baker came up from the Bob and Tom show, so I opened that show, and that's the first time I hosted for a big show, and like, you know what, I can do this, and sometimes my act is better. I don't have to worry about getting out of a hole from the act who came up before me or whatever. It's my show, I start with a clean slate, and that's kind of fun, so yeah. Yes, I have been enjoying it.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed talking to you here on the podcast.
You know what,
this is your first one.
This is my first podcast. And
how's it feel?
It's an honor to be my first podcast to lose my cherry to you.
I was your first. Well, tell people and the listeners how to find you. What's your website, email, all that kind of stuff. In case a booker hears this and goes, maybe I should give Dwight York a try.
Well, you know, it's DwightYork.com, and everything is Dwight York. You know, on Facebook, it's Facebook Dwight York. My Twitter feed is Vile File Guy. My new joke book, More from the Vile File, 500 Sick Jokes. And I've got clips on my website. Just Google Dwight York and you'll come with DwightYork.com.
Or you might come up with the killer Dwight York.
Yes. Yes, or him. Or the football player. There's a famous football player, too. Sorry. Anyway, yes, yeah. DwightYork.com.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for joining me on the podcast. We got two more shows tonight here in Oklahoma City, and hopefully we'll kick ass on those, too.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Thanks, Dwight. And thanks for listening to Remasculate. God bless America. Go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. I bid you adieu.